Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, let me grab the headphones. I'll get dialed into the studio. Get these dogs to shut up. Oh, goodness. I better close the window or the neighbors are going to get mad. Hope the guests call in tonight. Wonder if anybody's going to call in. Well, let's do this thing.
It's Rated G Radio, and this is your host, Garrett Miller.
Well, hey, everybody. It's Rated G Radio coming to you live from Hollywood tonight. And tonight we're going to have Gus Sains, a filmmaker, but more importantly, a great humanitarian joining the show tonight to talk about his passion project called The Human Time Project. So we'll have Gus on in just a couple of minutes. But a big shout-out to everybody who came out to visit on Saturday night for the Lust and Love red carpet event at the Vaucluse Lounge up in Hollywood. It was great to see Ken and Angela with Downey's Desserts. Of course, they're providing all of the yummy treats that everybody in the VIP lounge were gobbling up left and right. Able to see Dana and Lana and just tons and tons of familiar faces. If you get a chance to see some of the goofy pictures I posted on Facebook, do it now while the getting is good, because those pictures, as you know, don't last long. I try to keep all the content fresh and fun, so you'll see some updates there over the weekend. Also, I was able to get some major web redesign things going on, and so for everybody who's listening tonight, if I can solicit your opinion, you know, I don't ask for it very often, but I'm asking for it tonight. I would love for you to go to the website and check out GarrettMiller.com and take a look at the just really from a functionality standpoint, because if you haven't looked at it before, you go like, well, it looks fine, but you didn't see what it looked like before. So I'm trying to gauge, I guess, cosmetics. How does it look? How does it feel? How does it play for you as you kind of navigate your way through the site? I would love to have some feedback, and if you share that with me, I will be eternally grateful to you. I think it'll be fun to try to continue to make this a work in progress, to be something that's really kind of awesome. I'm putting in, you know, different things that I've done over the last year or so from a reel or a demo standpoint, so I can have that available need be. I'm learning tonight the exciting things having to do with Vimeo and how to get things like that to post to the site. So after tonight's show with Gus, I'll be kind of schooling myself on all of those fun things. Real quick, before we have the star of the show come on, Gus, in just a second, I'm going to give you a roadmap for the rest of the week. Tuesday, tomorrow, is Tarot Tuesday with Tarot Jeff. He'll be back for your free five-minute read, three-card draw on what's in the cards for me. Thursday, I've got Diana Barish, and she is a Grammy-nominated artist. We're going to be playing music for her and finding out about Diana for the hour on Thursday. And then Friday, we've got William Taylor out of Tallahassee, Florida, coming on for a very special early Friday night dance party. That'll be 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We'll be playing his songs. He's written a series of songs that are friendship-themed, and we're going to find out all about that on Friday, so make sure to tune in. So without further ado, I'm going to press the magical button and see if this is indeed our special guest, our Gus Sains, with the Human Time Project. How are you?
How are you today, Garrett?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you so much for calling in today.
No problem. Always glad to be invited to your show.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, here's the 6 degrees of separation, everybody. I met Gus, I've seen you once, I've met you once, or I've seen you twice, met you once, how's that, at the OC Screenwriters event in Orange County. And one of the things that I was curious about when I first had the occasion to run into you is that you, would do a giveaway for your watch, but it also is an opportunity to talk about the Human Time Project and why that was important to you. But before I saw that portion of the meeting that day, I'd also had a chance to visit with the filmmakers for the movie that you have written and produced called The Prey. So we're going to talk about that afterwards. That looks like a great film, so I'm excited to find out more about that.
Yeah, it really is. It was pretty much a labor of love that we've been working diligently in the last year and a half to kind of get it back to where fans are really clamoring back, you know, for the practical effects, you know, no more CGI, no more nonsense stuff. And it's kind of like a homage to 80s action movies, but with a little bit more modern twist, so better photography and better storyline. But it's really exciting, you know, and everybody's looking forward to that next year.
Well, let's kind of leave that for the I don't say the dessert, but for the main course tonight. I want to hear about the Human Time Project, because when I first heard you talk about this the first time, you know, it didn't really like sink into my thick skull. And then when I heard you talk about it in the September OC Screenwriters meeting and here in Fountain Valley, I was like, this is really kind of a cool big darn deal. So what is the Human Time Project, and how does it work?
Well, it's very similar. It's a company that I organized, and it's very similar to Tang Shoes, which has become increasingly a strong brand and very renowned for everybody. And for those who don't know what Tang Shoes is, it's basically a company that for every pair of shoes you buy, it's kind of like, you know, some sort of like, you know, South American slipper, and it has like different styles. And for every one that you buy, another one's donated to a child in need. And I've always loved that business model since it first came out in 2006, 2007 with Blake Makowski. And that was, I've always thought it was a great idea. But in those days, I had a watch company who specialized just in like, you know, very custom-made, very niche Swiss watches that I used to handcraft and sell by myself. And I always loved, you know, the business model of giving, but never really had an opportunity to kind of implement it, because I mean, like, you know, who needs a luxury watch? I mean, who are you going to donate it to? But then in 2011, my brother-in-law works for the World Bank, and I was meeting with him over in Washington, D.C., and I got the chance to meet this group of this mission that were going to, like, to humanitarian hospitals in Thailand. And I started talking to them to all the things, you know, basically that they do, because most people don't know that the World Bank is not a financial bank, but it's a bank that organizes all the world's donations and turns it into a humanitarian oversight. So I was looking over the list of things that they were sending. They were laying, of course, like cotton swabs, remedies, you know, medical equipment. But in the list was watches. And I said, well, watches, really? Because I'm a watch fan and a watch designer. How does that work? And they were telling me that most of people don't really understand that a watch is a very important, vital tool for healthcare. I mean, like, you know, people just to do emergency vitals on, you know, on a person that has a severe trauma, they need a second hand to kind of like, you know, coordinate, like, you know, pulse, movement, respiratory functions. And even in a recent study in England where they tested 20 doctors and nurses to check, you know, the vitals of respiratory and heart conditions of different patients without looking at a second hand, out of all the 20, only one of them was able to kind of get close to diagnosis, but everybody else took longer than necessary and didn't really diagnose the people to be, like, you know, severely sick, weren't diagnosed at all as being sick at all. So people don't really know that a watch is a very important tool for healthcare. Say, like, for example, in Africa or in Central America, a young child gets bitten by a poisonous snake or something. You only have so many hours to administer the anti-serum before it becomes hazardous to the body. So if you don't have a really good running watch, you don't really know what's the time frame. And most of these people in these clinics, first of all, these clinics are just so poorly conditioned that it's just horrible, the conditions that they work in. And second, they work with these really, since, you know, they don't have much income, they have these really substandard, like, you know, digital watches, and, you know, and that stuff is not really proper for that type of thing. So I came up with this business model and figured, well, you know, if we can able to do this type of one-by-one type of thing, every time you buy a watch, another one gets donated, I thought, wow, that could be kind of a cool thing. So I kind of got the idea in 2012, and then I started looking at these different factors and kind of producing, you know, the right type of watch for the right amount of money. It's something that had a quality, durability that can withstand, you know, different climates, water resistant. And then we started around, like, you know, the end of 2012, and we've been going almost 2 years strong. And happy to say, with this last summer, we passed over the 500 watches donated to different places.
Holy
in Central
cow.
America. Yeah.
So
it's
okay.
Been,
so
been really successful.
So now I got to go back and ask about the watch, because when I went to the website to take a look at this, and I've actually seen one in person. You know, I didn't get to hold it, because, you know, when you the raffle drawing at the OC Screenwriters, the person,
right,
that people have got, they're like,
yeah,
nobody gets to touch my watch, because, I mean, it's really kind of a big darn deal and a surprise. But these are like fancy, you know, world class looking types of watches that you expect to spend thousands of dollars for in a store.
Well, actually, Yeah, the reason that we kind of made the design a little bit exclusive was because I come from a watch design background, and like everything else, you know, product sells through the eyes. You have to have something that looks really nice for people to want it and to wear it. I mean, if you were just going to go a different route, like, you know, sending out plastic, you know, like, you know, merchandising watches like they do for the Red Cross or whatever, that wasn't done. Kind of people don't want to wear those type of things. So what I did is that I found the right factory that was able to give the right quality of products. I mean, our watches are being fabricated by a company from Japan that does the same type of watches for different companies, like, you know, for example, Fossil, Nixon, all these other bigger brands, you know, that are not extremely high-end, but they are really good quality for the money. And what we wanted to do is that we wanted to have some sort of good price point where people could afford, you know, to buy that. And at the same time, since, you know, we sell directly, we're able to kind of, like, you know, do the donation and with a little bit of, you know, of the money left over, let's the organization keep on running. So it's not like, you know, we have to go out and ask for handouts like a nonprofit. We basically fund ourselves, and that's the whole idea, which makes, you know, make it a great idea.
I think that's so super cool. Now, are you in charge of also the design, like how the watch looks and feels and all of
yes,
that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm kind of like, you know, the honorary title of Time Captain here
okay.
at the company. Yes, and I'm also the head of design. So I try to make things that look, you know, kind of interesting, kind of cool. We did a couple of limited editions, which completely sold out on the first week, because usually we publicize, you know, through the men's blogs, you know, like Cool Material, Houdinki, Bless This Stuff, and all these other bigger blogs. And once these things come out, since the price point is really good and the quality is good, they just usually sell out in the first week. And now, for example, we just came out with our latest model called the Centurion, which is kind of like, you know, Roman thing where people are just really loving it. We only made 100 of those, and 48 already are out. So if you want one, you have to try kind of order it in pretty soon, because, you know, we're running out of inventory. And that's the kind of the thing that I like about these designs, and what most of our friends and contributors like about also is that these are very limited production models. I mean, like, you know, it's like it's what I like to coin the term of affordable exclusivity.
Well, and it really is a genuine collector's item, and what a fantastic conversation piece. If you're not only does it look good, but you're helping other people, but, you know, when you're out and about, people are always going to say, "That's a really interesting watch or, you know, timepiece that you have. Tell me about it." So of course they're going to talk about it, but then they're going to help spread the word or tell the story, you know, because this is just something that, you know, when people are part of it, they get excited about it and want to spread the word about, you know, what you're trying to do as an impact. So do you have I know you've got like 50 of them, Gus, but do you have maybe one or two success stories or, you know, feedback that you've received from some of these healthcare
workers
around the world?
Yeah, what we do is that basically right now we work with a couple of different nonprofit organizations, and actually one of the ones that we kind of work the most is called Helps International, and they work mostly Central America, which is Guatemala, Honduras, and other countries. And one of the things that, like, you know, that was kind of interesting is that we usually, like, you know, we donate, like, you know, every 4 or 5 months we send out 50, 60 watches here and there for them to donate to the different areas. And the one time they went up to this one hospital up in the Guatemala Highlands, you know, it's basically the old jungle area. And the funny thing about this place was that they haven't done an operation in that hospital in over a year because there was no running water. This organization came placed water, and most of the people, now this is what is great about humanity, because these people who are working there, the medical staff and the nurses mostly, it was four months that they haven't received any pay, but they were showing up every day to treat people. And this is just amazement. So when they started giving out the watches, this one lady basically, when she received the watch, because, you know, the watches that we donate are really good quality. They're like, you know, really good casing. They have silicone rubbers to prevent, you know, like, you know, bacteria formation. They have Swiss movements. They're really nice little watches, you know, and they're basically designed kind of like for easy to read out and all that. And actually one of the nurses started crying, and the director, Carmen Gandarella, who runs, you know, Helps International, said, "What is the matter?" She said, like, you know, "I can't believe you're giving me something so beautiful." And she had basically was shocked that somebody was giving her something so nice, just, you know, and that's something that when I received that letter, it just kind of floored me, because I figured, like, wow, every single problem that I had, every time, you know, I had to get the watches out of customs, every single type of problem that occurred creating this thing, everything basically just went away with that one moment. It says, well, you know, if I can impact at least one person, and that person can impact the life of 40, 50 people in a month,
we already done our job. So
well, let's talk about this. How do you donate or how do you support the cause here? How do people get a hold of one of these Centurion watches that you've got going on right now?
Well, it's very easy right now. We sell directly to the public online. We don't have any resellers, but probably we might be doing a couple of trunk shows at the Orange County Fair in the next couple of weeks. So keep posted that on our Facebook page, which you can follow us easily at facebook.com/HumanTimeProject, and if you'd like to get one of our watches, it's very easy. You go to humantimeproject.com, and it's right there on the landing page. You can go up to the menu, say Centurion, and then it explains everything about the watch, you know, and then you can just basically go ahead and purchase online. So it's a very easy method, and we work with Chase Authorized.net, so it's a very secure also transaction. We also like to keep the privacy of all our people who buy in the United States.
Absolutely.
And the funny thing is that, we have a lot of clientele that's international. You're telling me also that your show is broadcast internationally. And we have quite a lot of people that we send out watches to Canada, to the United Kingdom, to Australia, to Germany,
wow.
Sweden, Norway. So the thing about the Internet has been incredible because through these blogs, that are men's magazines, and some of these blogs, they receive, millions of hits per day, So we get people from all over. Last watch we sent out to Singapore a couple of weeks ago. There was another one that went to Bahrain. Another one was going to Tonga, which, I didn't even know there was a country called Tonga. So all these different areas, which I'm just amazed, I'm very, blessed that people have been, embracing the project, and it's been so great. So and every time you purchase a watch, another one gets donated. And usually we go through these organizations, But what we do is that we do the donations every 5 to 6 months because, of course, we have to create a bulk because you can't send out international 5 or 6 or 10 watches. You have to be something like 80, 50, 100 to make, it worthwhile to pass through customs and all that. So then they get distributed to these different organizations. And these organizations are just fabulous. We just keep a record of everybody that, that receives a watch just for our own internal admission. They have to let us know where they're working at. And any person that has direct contact with a patient qualifies for a watch. So that's, basically how
so,
it works.
And you mentioned something just a second ago that really I didn't even give any serious thought to until you brought it up. It's how you ship these internationally. So you said you have to wait until you get a certain number, and then do you have to send a certain number to that particular country, or how does all of that work?
Yes, it's a lot of paperwork because basically, to ship basically 10, 15 watches is almost the same cost to ship 50 because these are small items and the weight, and since they go air freight through DHL, which is the only place that has, because people talk about, FedEx, UPS, but in some countries, it's not available. So it's mostly, European companies like DHL or other companies that kind of gets into Guatemala and these other places. So what we do is that we basically, wait until we receive a certain amount, that makes sense, to send in, and then it gets distributed. And the problem is also when these people do their missions, they go up to these different hospitals. You can't show up, with 15 watches and, there's, 40 people are going to be left wanting, So you have to make sure that people, so what we do usually when we work with Helps International, we kind of receive, hey, how many people are you going to be visiting this week or this month or so? And so we kind of organize it, through that way. But, yeah, usually we have to send them a bulk because, it's the same air freight, the same customs, the same everything that you have to pay for a certain amount, so might as well, make it worthwhile.
So how do the organizations determine who gets a watch and who's able to, kind of take part in that?
Right. Well, actually, what we do first is that we carefully select who are the organizations that we work with. For example, in Helps International, they basically run teams out of the United States and other places, and doctors go in and perform surgeries and all these different clinics, and they do certain training and certain services. So I know that these people are working directly with healthcare workers. It's not they're coming in to fix a well or they're coming in there, which are also
right.
Outstanding, beautiful things, that other organizations do. But this organization deals directly with medical healthcare and medical issues. So I know these people have direct contact with any type of person who's a healthcare worker. And any type of person who's a healthcare worker qualifies for a watch. May it be a nurse, a nurse assistant, an orderly, anybody that has to have followed any type of orders. And the problem is in some of these places, people don't really know that there's a doctor probably for every, 20,000, 15,000 people, or two doctors. And a bunch of them are what they call nurse practitioners, which are basically glorified nurses that can do exactly the same thing that a doctor can do, but they're not really doctors, And in certain part of Africa, that's very common, for highly trained nurses running, you know, the clinics over there. So, and these people at the same time have, you know, a small staff of healthcare workers who help them also. So these are the people who usually take the vitals, they dosificate the medicine, they kind of do like the first, you know, response treatment. So anybody who has a direct contact with the patient has basically qualifies for a WASH donation.
Cool. Now, let's talk about the bottom line here. You know, when at the end of the day, it's all great until we find out the price tag that, you know, it's $1 million to participate and buy a watch.
Right, exactly.
So what are the price points? You know, do you have more than one model that's currently out? What's
actually
coming up,
right now,
all
we,
of that?
Yeah, we do have two models right now. We do have the Naval Raider, which is kind of like an homage to friends of mine who are serving in the Navy. Kind of has like, you know, a cross and skull, you know, two swords in the skull, kind of like a more of an action type of watch. And that's also a limited edition. We only have 18 of those of the 150 left, and those retail for $165. And then we have the Centurion, which is a little bit more upscale in design. Comes with a leather embossed alligator strap, and it's a little bit more upscale and limited edition, and that retails for $170.
So both very affordable. I mean, if you go out to,
yeah,
unless you're buying
was,
like, you know, a Swatch or something, that's a great price point.
No, exactly, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to kind of design, you know, and fabricate ourselves and kind of sell directly to the public, because the problem is that people don't really understand that sometimes really, really expensive watches have, like, you know, 600, 700% markup, you know, and it's not that they're bad watches. The problem is that, you know, that's the way the industry works. I mean, like, you know, a Rolex or a Breitling that costs $6,000, $7,000 probably might not be more than, you know, 700, 800 to produce, but then they have the marketing machinery, then they have the dealerships, and then they have this, and they have that, and plus that up, and then, you know, I'm perfectly fine with people making as much profit as they can, but sometimes, you know, it's a little bit too high for most people to buy. So our main idea was to kind of make the watches as affordable as possible to make sure that the quality didn't suffer also, and make everybody be able to help out, you know, and have something that's kind of nice also. Because, I mean, if you buy something just for a donation and it doesn't look good, what really good use is it? You're not using it. It's just there on the drawer.
Right.
It's kind of tacky. It's not well built. So we figure, you know, we kind of figure that the sub-$200 is kind of like the sweet spot for people to kind of like, you know, do an impulse buy or something that's kind of nice. Or even now for the holidays, you know, people are looking for very unique gifts right now. And I think this is something that works really well, you know, for, you know, the male of their family or friends or people who are looking around. So we wanted to keep it affordable for people to be able to participate and, of course, you know, help us, you know, with the donations at the same time.
Well, I think that, you know, you'd mentioned a great point that, you know, we're coming up on the holidays, and, you know, right now, if you're looking for a special gift for the people that are in your life, they're great conversation starters, but they're great pieces of jewelry. I hate to call a watch jewelry, but, you know, it's not just, you know, some crappy old watch. This is a really, really nice, you know, something you're going to be proud to wear on your hand and, you know, show off and tell people about. You know, and I think the other thing that I really like about this, Gus, is the fact that, you know, your company really does have, you know, good humanitarian, I want to make the world a better place type of ideology behind this. And I think that's really important for companies today, especially if you're going to choose to go out and spend money over the holidays, to maybe think about where you can spend your money, get something, but also make sure that it's really giving back to, you know, people who make a difference as well. And I think that's exactly what the Human Time Project does. So big hats off to you. Big congratulations for all the work that
we
you're doing.
Appreciate it. We certainly appreciate that, the comment. I mean, a lot of people really enjoy what we're doing. And it's not that we're, like, trying to be, you know, holier than thou or whatever. I just figured out that, you know, this is a good way where commerce and social entrepreneurship can kind of, you know, marry each other. Things can move forward because we are a for-profit company. We're not a nonprofit. We are a for-profit company, but also that gives us a lot of benefits in which we can kind of, like, you know, we're not shackled by different rules and regulations, how much money we can spend for advertising, how much we can do this, how much we can do that. So it's basically just, you know, taking a step further and giving a little bit back, you know, and at the same time, you know, proposing, you know, different ideals, and, you know, and if something good can come out of it, I mean, even great, you know. So, I mean, like, you know, people have all the freedom to choose, you know, what they want to do with it. But I think it's kind of like, you know, the sign of the times after the huge, you know, the economic, you know, debacle that the United States and most of the world suffered that a couple of years back. I mean, I really see that, you know, people that were ostentatious in greed was being looked at the wrong way. I mean, even like the luxury market, you know, was even hit hard because people didn't really like, you know, want to flaunt, you know, that they were doing well because so many people were doing badly. But in this case, it's a little bit different because, I mean, first of all, it's extremely affordable. And second of all, it's kind of like, you know, a badge of honor. It's okay, you know what, I'm trying to do something that's a little bit different, you know. So I think it's kind of a win-win situation for everybody, and especially all these people who've been receiving these watches. I mean, believe me, it's making a huge difference for a lot of people. I mean, you might most people might not know the case of Manuelito Jimenez, which was a kid that had this bottle cap trapped in his esophagus, and then they came in basically like, you know, and he was breathing unevenly, and they came in, and of course, like, you know, one of the nurses was wearing our watches. He was able to immediately see that the breathing pattern was wrong by a couple seconds, and rushed right away into the emergency room, and they popped the bottle cap out, and they said, wow, that was amazing. I mean, not that, like, you know, a person who's not trained, they're not going to see that the kid has something lodged in his throat, but at the same time, you know, it was our watches that she was using to give medical attention, so we're actually very, very proud of that, those type of things, you know.
Wow, that is really, really cool. So for everybody who's listening live, and of course on the show page you see this, but this is just your reminder. You've seen, I think also I put some pictures up in the slideshow going across of some of the different watches that Gus has been talking about for the Human Time Project. There's a couple of things you can do. You can actually click the link to buy a Centurion watch on their website. That's the last link that's on the show page there. Click that, go buy one tonight. And, you know, think ahead. You know, you can buy a bunch of, fruit cakes or socks or sweaters that dad's really not going to like, or you can get him something really cool like the Centurion watch and, you know, help somebody else out around the world helping other people. You can also like the Human Time Project Facebook page, so do that. So now let's shift gears and talk about your movie, The Prey.
Awesome.
Cool. Okay, so you're like a twofer tonight. Okay, on the first half of the show, I've got, you know, Gus talking about this, and the second half, it's the movie. So you have this movie called The Prey. Can you tell me, I know that, you know, you mentioned a quick blurb at the beginning, but tell me about The Prey. How do you decide that you wanted to write this particular story, and how did it come together for you?
Well, The Prey is kind of a labor of love that happened between me and my friend Eric Hesman, who is one of the directors of the movie. He currently runs Lennox Productions, which is a nice commercial a company that does all type of commercials. I mean, he's done over 100 commercials for different companies under his belt. And he recently did a commercial for General Electric, which had a $120,000 budget, you know. So he was kind of like, you know, in the point where, okay, you know, I've done a lot of commercials. It would be kind of cool to get something in through the narrative. But like everything else, you know, this last year, every single part of the economy was hurting really bad. And the movie industry was no basically slouch in that effect. So the situation to fund movies was extremely hazardous. So imagine an upstart like us, you know, first-time writer and producer and a first-time director trying to get a movie out there, it was extremely difficult. I mean, like, you know, titans like, you know, people who directed like large-time movies, I mean, were having a hard time of getting funding. So if you think about it, we're just trying to get that idea out there. So every time we kind of met around, we kicked around ideas. Like, you know, I had this stuff that was left over from a previous production that I did. It was called Vietnam Gear that I had. And I said, you know, why don't we turn this into some sort of, like, monster movie, like a homage to Predator or something like that. And we started bouncing the idea around, you know, trying to get funding. Well, maybe we could shoot in Hawaii. That's more tropical. Maybe we can go up to Big Bear and have, like, you know, Germans, you know, have a play with an abominable snowman. Or maybe we can – and so the idea came coming back and forth until we kind of sit into kind of bring it into, like, you know, a war environment, which is Afghanistan, which is the reason is that we chose Afghanistan. It's very clear in everybody's mind. You know, people know what's going on. It's a very, you know, complicated situation, and that's, you know, where Americans are kind of like, you know, engaged, you know, serving the country, doing their thing over there. So we kind of figure, well, what if, you know, we get some soldiers, you know, and they're kind of, for some situation, they get trapped in a cave, and in the cave is basically a very, like, you know, scary creature they can't dominate. So that kind of creates the whole idea. So we kind of based it on that. And then Eric recruited the service of his brother, Matt, who's an extremely talented, not only writer and director, but also he's a master sculptor. He basically worked in the special effects industry for many years. He did props for Army of Darkness, The Shadow, a bunch of other movies, you know, that were like
wow.
really, really hit. So he was already like, you know, a master skills craftsman in anything that he can sculpt. So we come up with the basic design of a creature, which is called a Carnot, kind of like, you know, a nocturnal carnivore that kind of like moves around, that you're going to probably have to wait to see it until you watch it in the movies, because we don't want to spoil what it looks like. But we came up with a design, and Matt completely sculpted the whole thing. And using this in various contexts through the props and special effects industry, we were able to create a life-size, gigantic suit, a live monster suit, which is basically like, you know, the vogue right now, where people are going back, like, you know, to live-action props, because everybody's really tired, you know, of the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, like, you know, really bad CGI monsters and things that don't really look kind of good. So we wanted to go back to, like, to the 80s, have, like, you know, like a Predator suit, like in the movie Predator, where Schwarzenegger was, that it was a really live, you know, live-action prop, and it looked really good on, you know, on film. We wanted to go back to that type of filmmaking. So we came up with a really cool story. We came up with a monster. We got some initial funding. And then people saw what we were doing. I mean, like, you know, these guys hired a really great artist called Richard Carter, who then works in a lot of comic books. So he did a lot of really great storyboards. They kind of got more people interested. And when they saw what we were trying, they read the script, they saw the monster, which blew them away, because they had no idea we can come up with such, you know, really great work. And basically people started coming in, you know, to kind of help us out. And then we just got more funding. And then basically we were able to track down Danny Trejo, which is basically through another contact that Eric had. He was like, you know, another, you know, third degree of separation. We were able to kind of like, you know, after, of course, 4 or 5 months negotiating, because he's a very busy guy, we were able to bring him in. And then we needed a really tough, like, you know, older mercenary for the lead, you know. And we all, and Matt came up with the idea, hey, why don't we, the person that I kind of like for this character is the actor Nick Chinlin. You know, he was in Con Air, in Tears of the Sun, and Chronicles of Riddick. You know, he was a really great Cal Draco, a really tough, tough guy, you know, that would be great for this role. And one of our producers said, hey, I worked in a movie with him, like, you know, a couple of years back. Let me get in touch. No way. So suddenly he read the script. He really liked the script because, I mean, he has a little political views. Even though it's kind of an action monster movie, he has a kind of like a little political views through it. So that really, Nick really liked that part because, of course, you know, he's a person that, you know, that went to, like, you know, an Ivy League school in New York. And even though he's kind of like a big macho action guy, he's a very well-read, interesting guy, you know. So he kind of got on board. And then through another contact called Victor Fan, which is a friend of ours, you know, also from the Orange County, like, you know, cinematic group, he was able to get in touch, of course, with another person, you know, with Kevin Grievous, who was the original creator and writer of all the Underworld series movies, which is a really, you know, really big African-American guy. He's huge, humongous, but he has a heart of gold and a really deep voice. I mean, like, you know, every time he talks, the microphone rattles, you know. And he was in Planet of the Apes. He was in, and he also just finished, and he wrote I, Frankenstein, which is basically was out in the theaters a couple of months back. So we were able to, you know, kind of like, you know, our little movie started getting so much momentum. And we also had a semi, like, a little dream team of, you know, of action groups, you know, of action guys. So we kind of combined that with a group of young soldiers, you know, who are all first-time actors, but, you know, incredible, incredible performances from these first-time actors. And what happens is that, like, you know, they get trapped into this cave, and then they have to find a way out, and then, of course, then, you know, mayhem ensues, you know. So that's about it.
Well, you say that so easily. How hard is it to write a good screenplay?
Well, that's probably one of the easiest questions and hardest questions of all time, because if you really go back in on the whole genre, if you're going to be really cynical about it, there's nothing that's new under the sun. I mean, you can watch any type of movie, and any really good film buff who's seen a lot of movies can say, you know, this was based on the other. For example, when I first saw Gladiator with Russell Crowe, which is probably one of my most enjoyable movies, that I really love that movie, that whole movie, 80% of that storyline is completely taken from the movie called Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, which was a 1965 movie. And you say, what? I mean, like, you know, but when you start looking back at it, every single plot line, it was the same. And every single, and people will say, well, name me one movie that hasn't been made. And we have a lot of fun in these discussions. And they say, well, how did Inception come about? That was a completely original. And I said, you know what? You're going to laugh. But there was a Scrooge McDuck comic book in 1975, in which he goes into a dream, and when inside a dream, he tries to rob himself inside the dream. So, So if you start thinking about it, you know, it's extremely hard to come with something original. So what you try to do is you try to get a genre that you really enjoy as a writer. You try to shell out the best characters you can, and then you throw them up a tree and keep throw rocks at them, you know, for the 120 minutes. That's, you know, that's probably the best you can do, you know.
So how long did it – okay, so when you got the screenplay written, how long did it take from the time that you had it quote-unquote finished, you know, because sometimes it's never really finished, until you actually started the production on it?
Well, I wrote the original first draft, and I wrote the original story that kind of started the whole ball rolling. Then when Matt came in, he started contributing some of his ideas, which, you know, it's kind of hard sometimes when you bring in a new person, you know, to start writing, you know, is this going to work, is it not going to work. But actually, he has a very good comedic timing, and, like, you know, he put in a couple of extra jokes in there and a couple of different scenes and a lot of stuff that kind of made the movie work a little bit. So, and look at it from a different angle politically also, which was kind of entertaining, because it doesn't make it – it's a complete cookie cutter or, you know, rah, rah, rah action movie. You know, it has the little moments where it kind of slows down to make you think, you know, what's really happening around the world. But then after you kind of created that whole script, probably took us, like, you know, a year or so to complete the funding and then start shooting. But actually, I kind of lied, because we were still working on the script while we were getting the funding. So probably I could say after we completely locked the script, we started shooting 30 days later.
That's not bad. So you would go through the, you know, getting the crew and all of that. So, okay, so you're a producer. Can you explain to everybody what a producer really does?
Well, there's two types of producers. You have producers for, like, you know, for small independent movies, and you have big-time producers like Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever. Usually the main job of a producer is to get the money. He is a person that has the contacts, has, you know, the ears of the studios. They have, you know, basically all the money to get all the different funding. And he's kind of like, you know, the maestro of the orchestra. He kind of puts all – he gets the actors, he gets the directors, he gets the right crew, he gets the right department heads, kind of mixes it all around. But also, the high-level producers have a huge, huge understanding of the different laws in movie making, of the different requirements from all the different unions, all the different in and out, like, you know, securities and trades information. There's a lot of minutia that until you start making a movie – you know, that is union, that you have no idea of things happening. For example, I had no idea, but basically one of our producers, one of our more experienced producers, Lance Micchio, who did other productions that was kind of helping us out on this whole journey, is that since we were working on our union film, if we served lunch 15 minutes late, we could have been fined by the union. And they say, what? No, yes. It's incredible, all these different rules, I mean, that run around. I mean, like, you know, a fire safety advisor can shit on your production if a generator is not properly grounded. I mean, there's all these different things that you have no idea that can happen until, like, you know, somebody tells you, listen, you got to take care of this because, you know, it's light off in a couple of hours. And we were very lucky that, you know, most of the fire safety advisors that worked with, you know, were really great. And also what kind of helped is that we had a lot of people that were ex-military, including our UPM, which was an ex-Air Force officer, you know, and so he was running basically most of the stuff going around, Angela Ford, and he was able to kind of, like, organize everybody else. So we had a lot of military crew working on the set as basically grips, props, people, you know. So it was very, very organized. So when they came in, we kind of gave, the marshal kind of, like, you know, a tour. And so everything was working around. And then, of course, since, you know, Matt and Eric are allergic to cigarettes, it was a non-smoking set. So that basically took 90% of the risk out of the production right there. So we were able to – and actually, being our first production, we got a AAA rating by the fire department. So that was
wow.
Pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So,
yeah.
Okay, I guess, you know, as a movie viewer, you know, as somebody who goes to the theater, you really never think about any of that stuff that goes into, you know, getting the production going, running, and maintaining without having all kinds of different hiccups. So, I mean, that's really what a headache for you. But, I guess it has to be done.
Well, I mean, it was extremely long hours. I mean, I was usually waking up to make sure that the food was delivered on time, because we usually had three meals. It was like, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So it was up around 5:36. Do the whole day, run different, solve it. And what you do basically as a producer is you put out fires. every single problem that happens, you know, worst Gus, worst Lance, that's always like, you know, something there. They need this, they need that. We have to make sure that you know, everything is not only on the production side, but on the livable side. I mean, we have to have working bathrooms. We have to have, like, you know, functioning facilities. People have to be properly hydrated and nurtured. We were shooting it at the movie ranch in Santa Clarita in June, and it was like, you know, sometimes it was like 101, you know, 102 inside the cave set, and we had, like, you know, around 40, 50 people with actors and everybody in there. We had to bring in air conditionings, and we had to do all these different things. I mean, like, you know, and when we were running down, like, the original budget, you know, which actually the budget became so big that we had no idea it was going to hit that big. But if you look at it, I mean, if somebody told me before I started this movie that we were going to spend a lot of money just on microphones, you know, on batteries for the microphones, I would say, are you crazy? But one of the biggest problems in a production is, like, you know, sound. A movie with bad sound is a horrible movie. It takes you out of it. So you have to make sure that every single cast member has a lavalier mic, which is one of those, you know, of course, you know, you being in, you know, in broadcast, you know, that's a tiny microphone that goes with the remote control. But the microphone and the transmitter have a battery. So when you have 15 actors and cast all wired up, that eats up a lot of battery per day. And then when you have, like, you know, a 30-day shoot, you could just, you know, stand up the numbers.
Multiply.
And these batteries were not cheap. These are not, like, you know, double Ds, you know. So all these different things that start coming up, you know, and then you just kind of, like, you know, figure out, you know, like, you start working this, you start working that, you know. One time we had a scene where a tank burst through, you know, in one of the scenes, a real life huge tank. We got everything ready. Danny Trejo was on set. Everything was going. And then the night before, we found out that the tank couldn't pass because it was one of these big Abram tanks, couldn't pass the width of the main gate where the scene was going to happen.
Oh, no!
And we couldn't change, like, you know, we couldn't change the set, we couldn't do anything else, we can't cancel Danny. I mean, like, you know, he booked solid for the next 3 months. I mean, so what happens is that we were able to talk, you know, with Rene Veluze, which is the owner of the ranch and one of these, like, producers. He was kind of, like, in the scramble last minute. We're making phone calls at 10:30 at night here and there, and we were able to secure a smaller tank that showed up the next day around 8:39, and, like, you know, out of those crazy miracles, it happened, you know. But it's like all that stuff that you figure out, like, you know, that's not going to happen. I mean, like, you know. For example, we were doing this one scene where Nick Chinlin is talking a very important scene where he's talking about certain politics of the day, and he's actually carving an apple, you know, with a knife, okay? So we get ready to shoot the scene, and this is Nick's first scene ever on the movie with the first crew, with the new directors, everybody else, and they start talking. And he's a very, like, you know, very extreme method. I mean, he was playing a badass mercenary, so basically you didn't want to cross him that day. He was very, very, like, you know, intense. So he starts to peel the knife. We have it on this costume. He had, like, a really cool, huge Bowie knife and a smaller knife. He tries to start peeling the knife, and, of course, the blade was dull because it wasn't, you know, supposed to be used for anything else. He can't open up the knife. So he quickly changed to the other smaller knife that's also on the part of the back of the holster of the knife, and that knife doesn't cut either. So basically, we're scrambling, trying to find, like, you know, some sort of sharpening tool. Anybody has a sharpening stone, and finally we found something that can kind of sharpen up. And, like, you know, and 25 minutes later, we were able to come back with with the knife that was sharp enough for him to apple and do his thing.
That is,
I mean,
funny.
So, all these type of things that, like, you know, that you think about. And, of course, like, people are waiting. The crew's there. The lighting people are there. The sound people are there. The grips are there. The makeup's there. You know, production assistants are there. The cast is there. And they're all waiting, you know, for a knife to be sharpened. So it's just like, it's one of those days. And it was 18, 19-hour days because, like I said, I woke up at 36 in the morning, did all the rounds, finished everything up. And then at the end of the day, it was like, you know, we started shooting later in the day because, of course, since it was so hot, we did, like, you know, a later night shoot. So most of the time we finished up at 10 or 9:30, 10-ish. Then, of course, everybody had dinner. All the crew left, and I was there with Eric, and we used to watch the dailies at night, you know. And that went, like, you know, for another, like, you know, 2 or 3 hours. And look at this. This is what happened. What do you need for tomorrow? What else? What went wrong today? What do we got to make sure tomorrow? So I got back to my room probably, like, you know, 11:30, 12-ish, and then there answer all the emails from the production of the day. And then take a shower. And while you take a shower, and before you know it, it's, you know, 1 o'clock. And then in 4 or 5 hours, you have to be up again. So it's just crazy.
How long was the shoot?
After The shit was 30 days, in which we did two intervals of 20 days and then another one of 10 days.
Wow.
And the thing is that once we finished, you know, the first day of production, I mean, everybody was like a zombie. I mean, like, you know, we didn't talk to any, the core production team didn't talk to anybody like 2 or 3 days. You were just basically sleeping and eating around.
How long did it take to get into, like, kind of the rhythm?
Usually kind of like in the first couple of days, you kind of set everything up, you know, when you're working with a crew. But once kind of things kind of get oiled up, you know, and we had a really great, like, you know, head of departments. We had like a great cinematographer. We had a great head grip. We had a good makeup department. I mean, one of our makeup ladies was Anita Breivik, who her last movie was actually Lincoln.
Oh, wow.
Her movie before that was Captain America. She was in all the Hunger Games, and she was nominated for an Oscar for Titanic. And this is also one of the greatest things about, like, you know, friends and communication. She was actually friends of another friend of the producer, and she basically we had no business working with her because, I mean, she's just so high rated, so great. But we went with her one day, and she's just a lovely, lovely person, great, absolutely professional. She loved the idea. We lucked out that she happened to be, like, on hiatus those days. She had a couple of free days, you know, like, in a couple of weeks to work with us and say, listen, you know, we can't really afford you, but we would love to have you. I said, oh, sure, yeah, no problem. And I really like, you know, doing different things. And she did some of the most amazing makeup. I mean, there's a scene where, like, you know, Kevin Grievous gets attacked by the monster and his arm is completely slashed. And when Kevin came out of the dressing room, everybody was taking photographs because the thing looked absolutely real.
Wow.
It was just insane stuff. So we really lucked out, you know, with a bunch of people that helped us out through the production. And if I start naming names, I'm going to get in trouble because there's so many talented people that helped us.
Well, I am going to ask you at the end is if there's anybody you want to give shout-outs to. So, I mean, if you want to, you know, this could be, you know, I'd like to thank, and then you can list, you know, 50 people if you want. So I'm totally cool with that.
One of those Oscar lists, but I mean, there's so many people. I mean, our top production crew. I mean, in total, there was over 150 people that helped us make this movie. All
wow.
did an incredible job. I mean, there's one time where we're, like, you know, up with Erica at the afternoon at the shoot. It was kind of like, you know, hiatus because we were waiting, like, you know, for some equipment to show up. And we hiked up to the top of the mountain, and we saw the whole set. We saw the 5 trailers. We saw the generators. We saw the grape truck. We saw this and that. And we kind of looked at each other as what, you know, and it was kind of one of those, you know, aha moments to say, wow, like, we actually are making a big-time movie. It's kind of like, you know, it's the moment that you're just so involved in the process that you just don't sit down a couple of minutes and kind of, like, you know, breathe in, you know, that moment of success. But it was really great, and everybody really believed in the project, and everybody gave it all. And I just can't be thankful enough for all the hard work that everybody did, from the top producer to the lowest PA. You know, these guys were just rocking constantly. And, I mean, if you want, you can go to imdb.com, The Prey, and search on the search tab for The Prey, and we're right there. Yeah, and you can see the list of everybody who was involved. You know, if you have a friend or somebody that you know that might have been involved in The Prey, you can go there. Or also, you can go to facebook.com/The Prey, and we have a tons of photographs through the whole production where we did, like, you know, everything. I mean, we were actually very well documented photographically through the whole process. So if you actually want to see how a movie's kind of made, you know, on this level, you can go down to all the different photographs and see the people there. But it was an amazing experience, amazing crew. And, like, you know, and right now we're in the process of finishing up, you know, the editing part. So probably we'll be able to finally show it to people sometime next year. So we're really excited about the whole process.
Well, I was just going to ask, when is it coming out? So is this going to be something that's going to be slated to go to, like, motion picture cinemas across the country? Or are you going to go on demand on Blu-ray? What's the marketing on?
That's one of the things that we're kind of, like, you know, discussing with the top production team. We're going to be probably our main goal is to have a theatrical distribution. That's probably one of our mainest goals. But then, like, you know, the different channels of distributions are going to vary depending also on the moment or whatever. Netflix is a very powerful house right now. They can probably jump in and say, you know, don't sell it to Sony, sell it to us, you know. And sometimes, you know, money talks. You know? So we never really know what's going to be the end of it. But yes, we definitely like to have some sort of, like, you know, theatrical release, and then of course bring it out to different but again, that's something that we have to once the movie's finalized and the top, you know, production companies take a look at it, we'll be able to decide, you know, okay, which is the best route to have, you know, to have it seen by as many eyeballs as possible, because that's the ultimate goal. We want people to watch this movie, to have fun, to be entertained, to kind of like go on the ride, you know, that movie's really produced to you. And when people ask us, okay, what's the movie about? What's the nutshell? It's basically Eugene Summer Rose and Black Hawk Down meets Predator. And with that, I think that says a lot.
That says a lot. Now, I know that you talked about the carving the apple as, a funny story that happened during the movie. For a movie that's this serious, do you have any stories that you can tell that might be a little bit more lighthearted that might have happened, you know, off camera?
Wow. Well, the tank anecdote was pretty funny because, nobody saw that coming. You know, we went to measure the gate, for the lighting. That was kind of a crazy thing, but I don't know if anything else that I can kind of remember. I mean, I'm sure a lot of things happened in production, what else kind of happened. Well, I mean, the arsenal that we had for this movie was insane. I mean, we had every single cool, quote-unquote, military-grade weapon you can think of, from, one of those, automatic Gatling miniguns to high caliber 50 caliber sniper rifles. I mean, every types of gadgets, like rocket launcher, mortar launchers, every single thing that you can think of, we try to put in it. So
How do you get that type of stuff?
Well, actually, we work with a company called Evike, which they do a lot of airsoft products, which is kind of a sport. But the thing is that right now, the high grade of replicas of these firearms that are being produced right now are absolutely insane. You look at some of these things, they have exactly the correct weight. And I've been around firearms. I shot a bunch of stuff. I've known how to use most of these weapons. And you take these things, and they're all metallic, they're all stamped, just like the real things. The problem is that they just shoot pellets, plastic pellets. But some of the stuff is very, very accurate. And if you're not looking at it completely or you're not disassembling it, you can fool even the most trained eye. So we work with this one company who also was a contact through Eric, the director, Eric Hinsman, and he was, yeah, sure, no problem. I love the movie idea. I love the script here. And, use anything you need, just bring it back. So we got all this high grade. Oh, I do actually have a funny story. I mean, I was driving up down to the production one night when we kind of did a small hiatus and we were coming back in. Up to the ranch, and I was going up to Santa Clarita, and I don't know if I was speeding or not or whatever, but I have in the back of my truck a bunch of boxes that are kind of like missile crates. Okay, on the inside of my truck, I had the minigun. I had 14 AK-47s, eight M4 assault rifles. I had a Soviet rocket launcher. I had a gangbuster. I had a bunch of different crazy stuff in the back. And then on my front seat, I had a huge, huge amount of batteries, which I had no idea they can be used to detonate stuff. So I get pulled over by an officer. I mean, you're going a little bit too fast, and you start flashing the light, And I basically, I'm trying to find the film permit to kind of explain all this craziness of stuff that I have, And then at that moment, I was kind of lucky that, I was able to kind of explain what happened and show him the permit and what we were doing. And actually, he made me take out the stuff, and you can see that it was all replica. Even he was amazed. I mean, a trained police officer was amazed at the accuracy of these props, But you can see that basically, they were not weaponized at all. Nothing would fit in there at all. It's just all make-believe. But, it was kind of funny because the thing is, I knew I wasn't going to get in trouble, but sometimes these people don't know what you are, what you're doing, and you can be detained for 4 or 5 hours. You can be detained for 4 or 5 hours, and probably they keep you, or they can keep you overnight, and you never know.
Yeah.
And the problem was that we had to start production that morning at 9 a.m., and I had all the batteries for the microphone.
My gosh.
If I got in trouble, the whole thing would have started late. So, all this crazy stuff that you never think about, until things happen, But, of course, you transport the stuff, in the most, cautious legal way possible. And then the authorities understand, as long as you have proof of what you're doing, so that's why we always carry the work permits or everything. And the thing about these props is that, we treated them as they were real weapons. They were properly stored. They were properly stowaged. Everything was, done under the rules and regulations they should be done. So I guess that's probably why, I didn't get into too much trouble because everything, But, stuff like that you start thinking about it. Wow, so many stories, constant dust. One of the major problems that we had is that everything got extremely dusty because in that area, it's really, really fine dust. You don't really understand it. Of course, I'm sure you would probably been – you yourself or your listeners probably have gone to the desert, you know, motocross riding or done motorcycles or whatever, and it's a really extreme fine dust, or everything got into the cameras, into the microphone, into equipment. So every couple of days you have, like, you know, extreme cleaning to get everything kind of, you know, working out. And then, of course, when you go back to your to the room, you take a shower and you look down, and this stream of chocolate all this dirt that you had no idea was kind of, like, you know, stuck to you all day, you know. So it's crazy, but it was an absolutely amazing experience. And the movie, the parts that I've seen already, we have like a rough cut that we've been looking at with the crew and top production, and we're just absolutely ecstatic how well the movie is coming out and the quality of the acting and everything else. I mean, we put in a lot of hard work because we wanted, as film fanatics and film buffs, we wanted to make a movie that people could say, okay, wow, this is a good production. This is great. And we didn't want to rush it. We didn't, like, you know, make it into like a Sausage Factory movie. Okay, let's just, you know, shoot this one in 2 months and do another one. You know, it's not like, you know, nothing against Sharknado, who's made a lot of money. You know? But it is kind of like, you know, what it is. People, even the people who produce those movies know they're in the joke.
Exactly.
They know it's not a great movie, you know, but it is what it is. But we didn't want to fall into the category. We actually wanted to make something that was kind of like, you know, watchable, entertainable, and then hopefully, in that wildly desire, probably later on, turn into like these little, like, little cult movies, you know. So,
well, I think like that, you know, when you get ready to release the prey, I'd love to have you come back on and maybe get a couple of the actors or the directors on the show and just kind of talk about
almost
the experience.
Definitely. Sure, no problem at all. I mean, like, once we're kind of ready, we can kind of get Matt and Eric to talk a little bit more about the whole thing. And right now it's kind of like a little teaser, you know, so you can, people, if they're interested, with our Facebook or IMDb, to kind of check it out. But, I mean, yeah, it's going to be much more important. So probably we might be able to kind of, like, you know, get to you also when we do our little Kickstarter. We were thinking of probably doing a Kickstarter to kind of like get a little, it's
love
to kind of like, you know, polish up, you know, the because there's a lot of visual effects, a lot of special effects, there's a lot of sound design in this movie that brings it up to that really, like, high level studio quality that we wanted to show it to. So we definitely, when we're kind of ready to do something like that, I'll be more than happy to come back, you know, with the directors, you know, and probably produce a couple of the actors, and we can have, like, you know, an open forum, you know, and people just talk about, like, you know, what it is movie making in this day and age, and that, you know, and then these small independent movies are making a comeback. I mean, if you make something good, even though people said the movie industry is dead and it's hard and all the piracy, if you make something good, people will watch it, you know. So
the cream always rises to the top.
That's a great phrase there. That's a really great phrase.
Well, you know, I've seen, and again, keeping in mind, this is like 6, 7, 8 months ago, I saw a very, very short battle clip out of the movie that the guys were showing, I think, on an iPad or something like this at OC Screenwriters. And even just, you know, that minute or two of footage that I saw, I was like, holy cow, that looks great. And they're, you know, talking about how they're filming it and all of that. And I'm just shaking my head in amazement. So I can't wait to see the finished product. But again, it's The Prey. And again, you're the writer, producer on this. Everybody, this has been Gus Sainz. He's obviously involved with this fantastic new movie called The Prey. But tonight, really, it's about the Human Time Project and being able to go out and buy a really cool, high-fashion watch that looks great, is made with excellent materials, but it also is helping a healthcare worker around the world with vital abilities to help people in a time-sensitive nature. Gus, do you want to give one last pitch or promo for anything tonight?
Sure. Well, actually, we're very grateful, like, you know, that people just can kind of go ahead and take a little interest about us. And if you want to know more about us, you can just basically go directly to our website, humantimeproject.com. There's a couple of tabs about us, you know, and what we do and how we do things. And then if you want to order a Centurion watch, you can also go directly to the same website and just click on the tab where it says Centurion on the top menu, and it takes you directly to the page. And, yeah, and like I said, we only made 100 of these, so they're going to be very limited edition. Once we make these 100, there's not going to be any more. So, as like Garrett said, we kind of specialize in collector edition type timepieces. But then other than that, I mean, like, you know, that's kind of it. And, of course, you know, facebook.com/theprey. And then if you want to like us on IMDb, imdb.com/theprey.
There we go. Gus, thank you very, very much for being here tonight.
No, thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, what a treat! And I can't wait to see you at the next OC Screenwriters meeting and see what exciting things you've got going on. There was so much more we didn't even get the chance to talk about tonight, so I'll have to have you back for that. Everybody else, hang tight. We're going to have just a sliver of Mango Dreamers Forever. They were on the Friday night dance party that was so successful on Friday, and they got all kinds of great comments. So stay tuned for this. Have about a minute of that left, but come back tomorrow night for Tarot Tuesday with Tarot Jeff, and we'll see everybody live on Tuesday night.
Listening to Rated G Radio.